supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Late this afternoon, there were new charges in the case involving the 2012 re-election campaign of Philadelphia Congressman Bob Brady, as well as allegations that Brady paid $90,000 from his campaign fund to get an opponent out of the race. Now, Brady has not been charged, but court filings today are not good for the congressman. WHYY's Dave Davies joins us now to sort it out. And Dave, remind us where this allegation initially came from.
Well, there were some court filings by federal prosecutors several weeks ago. And essentially, it was what you just said. There was this primary campaign, a re-election campaign by Congressman Brady. This guy, Jimmy Moore, a former municipal court judge, was challenging him. And the feds in this filing said that Brady had agreed to pay $90,000 from his campaign fund to retire Mr. Moore's campaign debts if he would get out of the race. This came in a guilty plea by a woman named Carolyn Cavanis, who was a campaign staffer for Jimmy Moore, and she described how this was the deal, and they had to disguise the payments because it's not legal under federal campaign finance law to pay $90,000 from one candidate to another. So there were dummy companies and all. But the critical thing is she understood there wasn't a deal. This was $90,000 in return for him withdrawing, but her knowledge was secondhand. She said she heard this from Mr. Moore. That's what we had until now.
And so today, a criminal charge was filed against Jimmy Moore, the candidate who withdrew from the race. Now, what's the charge and what does it portend for Bob Brady?
Well, the charge that he is going to plead guilty to is filing one false campaign finance report. But the critical thing is that he, in his pleading, will say, yes, there was a meeting, which, by the way, was at the office of former Mayor Wilson Good. I spoke to him today. He said he set up the meeting, but he wasn't in it. It was Brady and Mr. Moore. And in what Mr. Moore is prepared to plead to in the government filing, it will say that he and Bob Brady had this meeting to discuss what Mr. Brady was willing to offer the defendant in exchange for the defendant's agreement to withdraw from the race. That's the language from today's filing. That's what Jimmy Moore is apparently prepared to testify to. So this is not secondhand. This is firsthand. This is the man who allegedly reached this understanding with Mr. Brady. Now, I spoke to Jimmy Moore's attorney, Jeffrey Miller, just a little while ago, and he said, yeah, there was an understanding, but he kind of characterized it in a somewhat more benign way.
It's not as sinister as one might think. It's a little more vanilla than some kind of a backroom kind of subterfuge to corrupt the political process. It really wasn't that. It was, in fact, an agreement by two politicians. One ain't going to win, so he's going to drop out. And he's got a lot of debt, and he doesn't want to stick folks. The other's got a lot of money. He says, I'll help you with the money.
So that's Jeffrey Miller, Jimmy Moore's candidate, kind of saying, it's a little slippery. But the fact is that the court filing puts Brady in a discussion about a deal. And so I also got Mr. Brady's attorney, Jim Eisenhower, who had this to say about that statement by Mr. Moore in this pleading.
We flat out deny them. Congressman never had any conversation with Mr. Moore along the lines charged in this information. And I'll match the credibility of Bob Brady up against the credibility of Jimmy Moore any day.
So there we are, Dave.
So if Brady had offered Jimmy Moore cash inducement to withdraw from the race, would that be illegal?
It's an interesting question, isn't it? And Jim Eisenhower, by the way, says that's not what happened. It wasn't a quid pro quo. But if it had happened, he doesn't think it would be a crime. And campaign finance law experts that I have spoken to similarly say, it does kind of happen. President Obama offered Joe Sestak some kind of inducement, it seems, to get out of the race against Arlen Specter a few years ago. So it's not clear that it would be a crime. But again, Mr. Brady's attorney saying, it's not what happened.
So how does it next get sorted out?
Well, the question will be, do federal authorities have plans to charge Mr. Brady with anything? And when I asked Jimmy Moore's attorney, is he prepared to testify? He said if he is called by the federal authorities or anybody else, he will testify truthfully. So the question is, do they do anything about Brady? We don't know.
Stay tuned. Thanks, Dave.
Sure.
WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. In other news this evening, the agency in charge of water quality in the Delaware River watershed took a step today toward a fracking ban in the eastern part of Pennsylvania. The Delaware River Basin Commission approved a resolution that could block any drilling for Marcellus shale gas along the river. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports the move has angered people on both sides of the debate.
The Delaware River Basin Commission has five members, the governors of New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, along with a federal member who reports directly to the White House. Three states voted to approve the resolution that aims to prohibit fracking and directs the DRBC staff to propose rules for treating, transporting, and disposing fracking wastewater. Industry groups oppose the move, saying it's misguided and that it ignores the economic benefits of natural gas drilling. And environmentalists pushing for a ban are also unhappy. Tracy Carluccio is with the Delaware Riverkeeper Network. Carluccio says the resolution calling for fracking prohibitions is too vague, and she worries that commissioners will allow fracking wastewater to end up in the river.
You could drive a drilling rig through the words that are in the prohibition portion, and then the other two portions are actually instructing the staff to develop regulations that could allow frack waste to be dumped into the Delaware River.
But DRBC spokesman Clark Rupert says it's too early for a critique. Rupert says the regulations have not even been written yet.
So we just ask the public to be patient. I know there's a lot of, you know, anxiety and anxiousness to see what's going to be in these revised draft regulations. The honest and truthful answer is we don't know yet.
DRBC staff has until the end of November to draft the rules. There will be a public comment period and public hearings on the proposal. It's likely the commissioners will not vote on any new regulations until 2018. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The push for a fracking ban in the Delaware River Basin is only one of many movements to cut pollution in the area. This Friday, at Camden County Community College, those conservation efforts will be discussed at a symposium entitled The Delaware River Watershed, Protecting Today and Tomorrow. Joining us now is keynote speaker Carol Collier, Senior Advisor for Watershed Management and Policy at the Academy of Natural Sciences, Drexel University. She's also a former Executive Director of the Delaware River Basin Commission. Carol, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What specifically is on the agenda for Friday morning?
You know, I think it's going to be an open discussion because the Delaware is such a unique resource for the region, so I'd like to get that across. But then it's also vulnerable, so I'm going to be talking about some issues that I see, and then there's a panel of four or five others that can really get into some of the policy issues.
So let's take it in turn. What makes it unique?
When you think where we are in this megalopolis of mid-Atlantic U.S., and to have an undammed river with pretty high water quality as a resource for us, not only drinking water for over 15 million people, New York City and Philadelphia included, but fishing and kayaking and just having access to the outside. It's a huge resource for a big region.
Pretty high quality. Is it on the rebound or has it stayed fairly stable for decades now?
You know, the headwaters area, you know, up above Trenton, say, has always been pretty good, especially the further you go up the river. But in the estuary, I mean, it's a working river. And if you look back in the 50s, 60s, even 70s, it was really polluted. You know, fish couldn't swim upstream because there was no oxygen in the water. Paint would peel off of boats, etc. So there have been huge improvements in the quality in the estuary. However, as we learn more from science, we know that there are other parameters, man-made parameters, that we have to worry about. Things like PCBs, polychlorinated biphenols, that's an insulator. Things like the emerging contaminants, hormone issues, pharmaceuticals. So there's lots of little stuff that can still hurt the river.
A, how do they affect things? And B, how do we limit or eradicate the use?
You know, it's something, the PCBs is a great story because it was coming from numerous sources in the past. Nobody's making it anymore, but it's still coming through the stormwater of major dischargers. It's coming from the air, et cetera. And we took 7 years when I was at DRBC, working with both EPA regions, Region 2 and 3, headquarters, all the states, the estuary states, numerous agencies, to try and find a path to reduce PCBs, knowing it'll take a long time because it's in the sediments, that the dischargers could agree with, the environmental organizations could agree with, the agencies could agree with. And we're on that path. PCBs are going down. We have a standard in place that when it is reached, there will be no more fish consumption advisories for PCBs. So we have to keep our fingers crossed that the pressure will still stay on, but we can get there.
To what extent is that path more arduous given, quite frankly, the current political climate regarding EPA and other regulatory agencies that are tasked with overseeing the environment, be it water or air?
I am concerned about the current situation with reduction in inspections and just overall attention to the issues. You know, DRBC is funded by the four basin states, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, and the federal government. And there's a whole equation of who pays what. They are not getting near the payments that they are supposed to get. And therefore, you know, cannot do
the federal portion.
Federal, they haven't gotten anything except once. But Pennsylvania is way down. Other states are way down. So it's not just the federal government. So with that, they're limited to their core mission, but they can't really do some of this multi-attribute planning that really should be done to protect water supplies and water quality.
Carol Collier, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Carol Collier is Senior Advisor for Watershed Management and Policy at the Academy of Natural Sciences, Drexel University, former Executive Director of the Delaware River Basin Commission, and keynote speaker at the Delaware River Watershed Protecting Today and Tomorrow. It's a symposium this Friday at Camden County Community College. New Jersey U.S. Senator Cory Booker is throwing his support behind a measure providing universal health care to all Americans. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, a single-payer system would fund basic medical care for everybody.
Just look to American history, Booker says. People fought for voting rights, civil rights, even the right to a public education.
But when it comes to one of the most basic aspects of the ideals of life and liberty, you must include that every American has access to quality, affordable health care.
Former presidential hopeful Senator Bernie Sanders is sponsoring the so-called Medicare for All bill, and more than a dozen Democrats are joining him. They say Canada, Australia, and other developed countries already have government-funded universal medicine, and their citizens are healthier. Booker says the U.S. system has to change.
And so let me just end with the words of one of the patron saints of New Jersey, a man named Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
He says it proudly. We are a nation that takes care of its own.
But it's Washington, so politics are at play, too. Among the other co-sponsors of the Senate bill are Kamala Harris of California and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. Booker, Harris, and Warren have all been floated as possible presidential candidates in 2020.
The first hurdle that any of these individuals would have to pass through is the Democratic primary process.
That's Montclair State University political science professor Bridget Harrison. She says the liberal cred they get by backing a progressive issue like universal health care could carry them through the primary.
You have to court liberal Democrats. They matter.
What also matters if you want to pass legislation in Congress is who's in the majority. Right now, it's Republicans, which means the prognosis for this bill is, well, not very good. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
In Lancaster County, an intensive program aimed at helping people integrate into society after leaving prison is drawing the attention of officials across the state. WHYY's Bobby Allen paid a visit to Lancaster. He was trying to figure out what's made the city's reentry program so successful and what Philadelphia leaders can learn from the model.
In Philadelphia, around 60% of people coming out of state prison commit new crimes. But it's less than 20% for those who complete an intensive reentry program in Lancaster. Some of its services have helped transform the life of 41-year-old Isaac Rivera. He served two decades for several violent crimes, including aggravated assault and rape. He remembers first learning of the program at Lancaster's probation and parole office after he was released in January.
Sitting in the lobby, I saw a brochure, said that just got out, and I pulled the brochure out, and lo and behold, it talked about a support group for those who are returning citizens.
There, Rivera met other people who are struggling trying to get back on their feet. He recalls talking to the group about one of the challenges he was confronting after being out on his own for the first time since his 1997 arrest.
20 years, a lot of stuff has been lost, and so here's the catch-22. I can't get a birth certificate without an ID. I can't get an ID without a birth certificate.
Hearing that others share this experience made going through it easier. Melanie Snyder with the Reentry Management Organization says that's no small thing.
There are so few places where people who have been caught up in the criminal justice system can feel like their voice matters. Coming into that space every week where they know that they are going to be accepted and welcomed and respected and loved is like this manna from heaven. Mm-hmm.
These twice weekly sessions are just a small part of the schedule that former inmates in the intensive program are put on. It's kind of like boot camp for ex-offenders. They're set up with transitional housing. They have days full of job trainings, workshops on life skills. They're assigned a case manager and have weekly goals. And probation and parole officials in Lancaster, usually on the other side of the aisle, are partners in the program.
If you address the things, the need areas that are making a client's risk to recidivate higher, in other words, you reduce that individual's risk level, by definition, you make the community safer.
That's Mark Wilson, who runs the county probation and parole office. Top probation officials usually focus on law enforcement, not the human service side of things, making his working with the service providers pretty significant. Lancaster's reentry organization is housed in the same building as probation's intake unit, so when someone's released from jail, they meet both with a probation officer and then start learning about reentry services. Wilson says that's no accident. From there, ex-offenders might meet Doug Hopwood, who runs the housing site called the Transitional Living Center. Most just call it TLC. Giving a tour of the halfway house in the former hotel, Hopwood notes a key detail, a private bathroom.
If you're coming out of prison and you have your own bathroom, it's a pretty big deal. You want to get down to Maslow's lower level? Yeah, there's some things that we all take for granted that are pretty big deals.
Living at TLC comes with supervision. They have to keep their quarters spick and span. They have to be civil neighbors. Hopwood says these goals help people transition out smoothly.
And landlords care about three things. They care about paying your rent on time, keeping your place clean, and being a good neighbor, which are the three things that we monitor here. So when it comes to talking to that landlord and advocating for that person, we can do that with a clear conscience because we've been doing that the whole time.
But before the former inmates can start paying their rent, they need to find a job. For that, they'll walk to a program called Career Link. Brooklyn native Rolando Ponce is a supervisor there. He says it's more than just learning about how to put together a resume and helping connect returning citizens to employers. They will take classes on those things, but they're also learning what he calls soft skills.
If you're currently out of prison and you're going to an interview, don't go in anything that's ripped, stained, or dirty. We want you to look presentable, so we'll put you in slacks, dress shirt, or even a suit if you want. We have all that here. We try to be a one-stop shop and not offer every solution, but as much as we can.
Pomp says not everyone gets it right away, but he says he likes to emphasize a point with them.
Do you want to keep repeating the same cycle or do you want to break that cycle?
Officials in Lancaster have learned that something little, something that should have been avoidable, can often send a former inmate back to jail, like missing a payment on court fees. That can cause a probation violation. To avoid this, once someone gets into the intensive program, the fines and fees former inmates usually have to start paying right away are put on hold for 6 months. Top probation official Wilson agreed to this grace period after advocates pushed for it. Reentry group head Melanie Snyder elaborates on why this minor policy change has had a big effect.
When you've got somebody who has no income, they're struggling to find a job, they're struggling to even get food. And then you tell them, and by the way, if you don't pay $50 a month toward your fines and costs, you could be locked back up or you could have your food stamp shut off. That's just enormous stress.
A major caveat of the reentry group is that it's pretty small. Last year, the intensive program served just 52 people. Most of them stayed out of trouble, but doing that cost $175,000. Snyder argues that rehabilitating former inmates costs taxpayers half of what it does, keeping them behind bars. Here's another disclaimer. People have to want to be in the program. They have to apply for it while in jail, then they're vetted. Snyder says when she interviews potential enrollees, she listens carefully to ensure they have the right attitude, but maybe aren't likely to succeed without any help.
It's someone at medium to high risk of recidivism, with lots of needs, little or nothing in the way of resources, but who is wanting to make a change.
For Isaac Rivera, serving those 20 years motivated him to set his life straight. But even still, he says the programs as part of the Reentry Management Organization, or the RMO, have helped him stay focused on hard days.
Self-determination is just like a gas tank. It does run empty. So without the RMO, without career links, I would have folded a long time ago.
In Philadelphia, Cecily Bradford Jones is the executive director of the mayor's reentry program.
Lancaster's model is phenomenal. It is one that's probably going to be mimicked throughout the country.
Philadelphia is 26 times the size of the city of Lancaster, meaning there are tens of thousands more people being released from prison every year. But Bradford Jones says Lancaster has created a model where all of the players have a very specific role, and even law enforcement has a hand in helping former inmates restart their lives. She says Philadelphia officials should study the Lancaster model, because even if it's serving a limited group of people, it's been able to figure out how to change behavior in a meaningful way. And that's no small feat. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
This feature is part of the Reentry Project, a collaboration among 15 Philadelphia area newsrooms on the challenges of and solutions to prisoner reentry. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.